Welcome to Week to Week, everybody, the political roundtable program from the Commonwealth Club of California for Wednesday, April 1st, 2015. Thanks for joining us here. I'm John Zipperer, the club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, including the spread of religious protections legislation, such as the one that's causing Indiana so much headache, email troubles of the rich and famous, other political personalities, trouble in San Francisco jails, and the sex discrimination suit that's rocking Silicon Valley. So as usual, any opinions expressed here are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there with Carla Marinucci, a senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. She's also a political blogger at the sfgate.com's Spin Cycle. Next to her is Bill Whalen, a research fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's also a political blogger with adayattheracesblog.com. And next to me is Deborah J. Saunders, the columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and also the token conservative blogger at sfgate.com. That gets a laugh every time I say it. It's the perfect name for a blog. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and submit any questions. I will do my best to ask as many as possible during the program. Now on to our roundtable. I wanted to start with a piece of legislation called a Religious Freedom Restoration Act that has caused a lot of headache for Indiana, its governor, and its business community. If you don't mind, I'm going to start with you, Carla, on the end. Tell us a bit about what this is. And let's get into then why it's causing so much headache up there.
Religious Freedom Act in Indiana is causing a huge amount of controversy. It's not the first time this kind of law has been passed, although this law is different. And Deborah is going to maybe disagree with me on some of this stuff. She's just written about it. In 1993, when the first law was passed, a federal law, the idea was to protect religious freedom from government intervention. In the cases that involve, for instance, Native Americans, and use of peyote in ceremonies, a Muslim man who wanted to have a beard, and now Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, signed a bill that has now really, I think, fired up activists all over the country, because it is different from the laws in 19 other states. It expands what a lot of critics say could be potential for discrimination against gays and lesbians by expanding the definition of corporations, by allowing individuals, private individuals, to basically engage in lawsuits with regard to this. And I think we've seen just a firestorm of criticism as a result of Pence's action. I think the interesting thing to me is, if Mike Pence wanted to run for president, he's pretty much, I think, just very much damaged his chances in doing so by his handling of this whole story. He had kind of a finger in the wind approach to it. He wouldn't talk about whether it really did discriminate against gays and lesbians. And I think the other interesting thing from our point of view here in the Bay Area, we've seen Silicon Valley really rise up and weigh in on this. Big companies, Twitter, Square, Google, Apple CEO Tim Cook, who's gay, have all come forward. Now, after Arkansas signed a similar bill this week, Walmart now. So we haven't seen the end of this. I wrote a story today about how Jeb Bush is here in the Bay Area today and tomorrow collecting money for his presidential campaign, and he's taking heat for defending the law and defending Governor Pence in this. So I think this is an ongoing controversy that is not yet finished.
Yeah. Deborah, you did write something about this recently. What was your take on it?
Let me agree with one thing only that Carla said. And that is, Mike Pence, governor of Indiana, went on this week Sunday to discuss this measure, and he was pitiful. He should have said, George Stephanopoulos said, should a florist be able to say no to working at a same-sex wedding, and Pence wouldn't say yes or no. And what I think the governor of Indiana should have said is, well, you know something? If you believe in rights for people, you have to believe in them for things that you may not agree with them, but you believe their right to be that way. Now, this measure actually isn't really that different from other measures that were passed back when, we'll call it the peyote law, because basically the first federal bill that was a Religious Freedom Restoration Act was designed to make up for a bad Supreme Court decision. When the government says that somebody does not have a right to exercise their religious freedom, which, by the way, did anybody know that's in the First Amendment? Oh, yeah. When the government does that, it has to have a compelling reason. And what this Indiana law does, would do, I guess, we'll see what happens, is allow someone to use that law if someone sues them for not wanting to basically cater to their same-sex wedding. It's not an automatic thing. The courts are not likely to give that person that, but it gives them a possible defense in civil litigation. And so why is it everybody's making a big deal out of it? Because this is a herd mentality, and Mike Pence is a wounded bunny, right? And everybody, it just astonishes me. He doesn't stand a chance. This is corporate America. Now, we all know that Apple is really big on human rights and would never go for any violations, and that's true for all of these other big tech industries. This is the cheapest, stand up for human rights bid they can do. They can pick on Indiana. They wouldn't dare do it to China. Not in a million years, but Indiana is easy pickings.
The difference here is it's very clear who pushed this law and why the law was pushed. It's because of same-sex marriage, and the proponents of the law said so. And that was one of the reasons why Governor Pence signed this law in the dark, surrounded by the proponents of the law. He didn't do it out in the open. I mean, I just think...
I don't think he was...
He did not sign it in a public ceremony. He signed it in a private ceremony surrounded by the people, the supporters of this law. We've already seen some of the outcomes. Indiana, a guy who owns a pizzeria says, I'm not serving gay people. I just think you've got to take that into consideration. This is not the same law as the federal law. It does expand, and that's the big concern.
So following the argument that, okay, if someone were to decide, that their religious values tell them not to do that, to serve a certain a gay wedding or perhaps any other number of things, that any other number of things could be a lot. So just to let us know, how wide do you take that? If someone, for example, thinks evangelical Christianity is a warping of Christian belief, could they say, I don't want to serve evangelical Christians?
I do want to make this may irritate people that'll make this point, but to my view, I don't think that they're saying we're not going to serve gay people. It's we don't want to participate in a same-sex wedding.
They're not getting married. I mean,
yeah. Well, but that's not saying. But here's the thing. In my view, if you're a lesbian couple and you go to a baker and the baker says, "I don't want to make your cake," you go on Facebook and you tell everybody, "Joe's Bakery doesn't want to sell to us." That's a way where everybody. That's freedom. That's people standing up for themselves, but not using a coercive government to get their way. That's why I think, to me, that would be the way to handle it. And my guess is Joe's Bakery is going to have a change, but maybe not. Maybe Joe's Bakery says it's more important to me to live with these values, and if I have to go out of business because no one wants to buy cakes for me, so be it. But in my mind, that's what freedom is. And I'm sorry, folks. You're free to disagree. But just remember, this is a very popular, easy thing for people in San Francisco to push and look at Indiana and point there. But the rights, because it's a very unpopular position here. But if you decide that you can go after unpopular rights, one of these days the rights you cherish may be unpopular too. So you might want to think twice about it.
Bill?
Well, let me add this to it. I worked in a past life for a California governor, Pete Wilson. I can assure you that any time a governor signs a law and 2 days later has to take back the law, rewrite it, he's done something wrong. He's made a bad move. I can assure you that if a governor goes out on national TV and cannot answer point blank whether or not a bill is discriminatory, he is not prepared. Sloppy staff work, sloppy governor. Bad. What bothers me here is this. We are possibly entering a really bad phase of public discussion in this country. If you have a Bush and a Clinton on the ticket in 2016, in addition to Maureen Dowd's head melting down from having to get her head around this race, the left is going to go berserk over the fact that there's a Bush on the ticket, and the right, as it already is, will go berserk over the fact that there's a Clinton on the ticket. The last thing we need is more noise. What saddens me about this law is how it just adds noise, needless noise when you get down to it. I agree with Deborah on this. The marketplace ultimately corrects. Somebody chooses not to do business, people take their business elsewhere, that business goes out of business. The marketplace reacts to it. Secondly, I can tell you, having spent a lot of time talking to young Republican groups, those people I talk to who aspire to be the next Rush Limbaugh, the next Ronald Reagan, the next Ted Cruz, they don't aspire to be a florist or a baker. It's not exactly a hotbed of conservative activism. What truly bothers me, though, about this is just the not feigned indignation, but what I'd call half-baked indignation. And here I'm going to point directly at Tim Cook from Apple in this regard. Tim Cook sees fit to put out a statement from Apple about how righteous Apple is, how wonderful Apple is, how we're offended, and how we do wonderful things for humanity. This is the same Apple that, in addition to doing business in Indiana, does business in Uganda. If you're caught committing a homosexual act in Uganda, you're handed 14 years in prison. If you're convicted of what's called an aggressive homosexual act in Uganda, you're put to death. Tim Cook is offended by Indiana, yet he seems fit to do business in Uganda. Ditto Saudi Arabia, where if you're caught committing a gay act, you're flogged 40 times with the lash. So to me, this is sort of half-baked indignation. You jump on an opportunity. I would add to that, by the way, on the dog pile, America's governors. Governors are ultimately vultures. They just swoop into other states and they steal people's jobs. So I wonder how truly offended Andrew Cuomo is, the governor of New York, how truly offended Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, who's essentially one step ahead of the law on most issues, how outraged they truly are, or the fact they just see jobs for their state. So I just see this as really just a lot of kerfuffle in which it brings out in many ways the worst instincts and the worst motives of people.
I don't think it's noise when people stand up for their civil rights. I don't think it's noise. I didn't think it was noise in the 1960s when African Americans sat down at lunch counters and asked to be served, and there were plenty of religious objections to that as well. There was no danger in Indiana that religious freedom was somehow being eroded there. We know the reason this law was passed. It was because proponents did not like same-sex marriage, and they wanted to do an end run around it.
They wanted to have the option to opt out of it. I mean, the courts, is in case people don't know, courts, the federal courts have basically legalized same-sex marriage in Indiana. It is legal. And there are people who feel that there ought to be, that if there are people who don't want to participate, that they ought to have the right to do that.
People who feel for religious reasons they don't want to serve people with turbans, or they don't want to serve people of a certain color, or they don't want to serve people of a certain lifestyle. And in this country, is that where we really want to go? I think the protection should be there for people.
19 states that have this law in the book.
They are not the same law. It is
Carl,
not the same law.
And
this law has expanded the definition, and it expanded the definition of corporations to groups of people who maybe have some control.
Hobby Lobby
was about a religious family that was
wanted
challenging
to opt out.
A governmental regulation.
The reason that
this allows
when they originally wrote the RFRAs, I'll just to say it quickly, it was to cover more than just governments. But then the courts narrowed the ruling, and that's why one of the reasons why the laws became more expansive. But with Hobby Lobby, I think it's sort of superfluous anyway.
I found it kind of interesting. I lived in Indianapolis for 2 years in the early 90s. I considered it my domestic exile. When I lived there, there were two daily newspapers, the Indianapolis Star, the Indianapolis News. I believe the News is no longer here. Both of them, I think, had a connection to the Quayle family. None of which matters to what I'm about to say. Just that both of those papers would print Bible quotes prominently. One of them did it on the front page. We're not talking about a liberal city.
Indianapolis has a same equal rights for gays.
And they are voting on expanding it or something like that. Yeah, and they're Republican. So. They have a long history of what moderate Republican governors, Hudnut, the current guy, Ballard. But there is a lot of homegrown. It's not all just outside companies coming in and saying, we disagree with this. This is a very, very loud argument within Indiana among Republicans and Democrats and really across the state. I mean, this is a dumb thing to say. It's an interesting thing to watch because I don't think they were expecting. I mean, Governor Pence said he was not expecting this at all. He was kind of blindsided. It doesn't surprise me that Salesforce and Apple came out against it. It does surprise me that NASCAR came out against it, which is not really the voice of the, you know. There's not going to be a NASCAR float in the Pride Parade down Market Street.
Be debated in North Carolina, which is home of NASCAR. There's a simple fix here. Every state in America can pass an anti-discrimination law if they don't have one already, and they can be very specific in their language as to what discrimination constitutes, what constitutes discrimination, be it race, gender, religion, and sexual orientation. And not to get too forward in the program here, but this is now a question facing Republican candidates in 2016. How do they define sexual orientation? Is sexual orientation to them discriminatory on the same par as race, gender, and religion?
You've hit on something here because, I mean, when you're talking about the presidential race, Jeb Bush, as we said, is here in the Bay Area asking for money from these very companies in Silicon Valley. I was down there today at the Four Seasons in Palo Alto where the Bentleys were pulling up, to go to his fundraiser there. So at the same time, you mentioned Tim Cook. Look, I don't know how much influence he may have over what the government of Uganda does, but he certainly, as an American citizen, has the right to express a view, especially when these guys are coming to him, and as they are with every CEO in Silicon Valley, to ask for checks for their presidential campaigns. So they have a right to express their view, and I think that the Republican candidates are going to have an issue here as this campaign goes forward. As Jeb Bush doubled down on this issue and said, he supported Mike Pence. There was no discrimination. And he thinks that the people will see there's no discrimination in the law. And now Pence has turned around and basically said, yeah, there's a problem. I think every one of these candidates, Rubio, Cruz, they've all doubled down on this law and come and supported it. And I think when you see how many states now have endorsed same-sex marriage or now have it, I think it's 37, are the Republicans going to be sort of out of the mainstream on this issue when it comes to the campaign?
Well, Carla, just 7 hours ago, in fact, right on this stage, former Congressman Barney Frank was here. And he was asked about, of course, the Indiana law, among other things. And he was saying, as far as the Republican candidates, that he thought they were looking forward to the Supreme Court finally making its decision, hoping it will then take this off the table as an issue. And if their supporters there, you know, on the far right are just saying they can't stand same-sex marriage, they can say it's the law of the land at this point, and thank God they can change the subject. What do you think about that? Do you think Barney was right?
I mean, I think he's right in some respects, and I think, that a lot of these candidates would just like to say, hey, it's out of our hands. But I think it's not just on this issue anymore. I think that the Republicans are going to have a problem in terms of being out of the mainstream. When you talk about climate change, when you talk about immigration, Cuba and the changing policies there, the polls are showing the American people are one place on all these issues, and the more increasingly the main Republican candidates, the major ones, are not there with public opinion.
The President of the United States believes that the government should discriminate against gay couples and not allow them to marry. And now we're told that's so out of the mainstream that if any florist thinks it, I don't want to be part of that.
Weren't reading David Axelrod's book. He was
yes,
you
I know. He lied. He lied. So that's definitely, so it doesn't really matter. And now this is supposed to be such a horrible out of the mainstream opinion that it's supposed to drive you underground. I mean, does anybody feel a little uncomfortable about things switching so quickly from this to this? Okay, well.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Folks.
Okay. Get you covered, don't worry.
No.
getting back to the Barney, I think Barney Frank talking about Republicans is like me talking about women's fashion. It's just not the thing. If he thinks Republicans are going to give up on same-sex marriage because of a court ruling, why didn't Republicans let go of Obamacare 2 years ago with the court ruling? It doesn't. This is a very, very serious issue to Republicans because there is a very vital constituency of Republicans who are Christians, and there are Christians out there in the flyover parts of America and other parts, trust me, for whom they will not let go of this issue because it does go to their religious beliefs. So the question is, if a Jeb Bush or whoever is the nominee comes forward, can he marry the two issues, if you will, pardon the bad pun? Can he talk about religious freedom, but at the same time also talk about discrimination? And again, I get back to the same question, will he expand among conservatives the definition of discrimination to include gays? Plain and simple, will he, in other words, move a new litmus test forward? Republicans historically are loath to do this. Again, I worked for Pete Wilson years ago. 1996, Republicans had a convention in San Diego. Wilson wanted to modify the abortion plank in the Republican platform. He wanted to take it out and neutralize and put in common language saying no matter what our belief on the issue, we all believe that the vast number of abortions in America is a tragedy. We need to find ways to remedy the situation. Instead, he was shot down by his party. They do not, still to this day, want to go on abortion. And I don't think they're going to let go of this issue anytime soon either.
Okay, well, we're going to let go of this issue now. And move on to something Hillary Clinton would like us to forget about. So Hillary Clinton had a bad few weeks, right? The stories came out that she had used private email while she was the U.S. Secretary of State. Then in her press conference explaining that, she revealed that she and Bill had their own server at home, which was kind of cool because I didn't think they were that technologically. I mean, we all know she uses email because we all get an email from her every day, right? Her or Chelsea or Bill.
Oh, it's incredible. Every day you get Hillary merchandise, ask for money for Hillary costs. It's incredible. I'm sorry, John.
Well, let's talk about this. I mean, it, of course, something else that has come out after this has been all the stories about all the other politicians who, and here in California, we've got a lot of them who've also used private email. So start with you, Deborah. Is this just kind of the controversy of the day, or is this, as kind of the Time magazine was saying, the Clinton way we have to get back to being used to?
This is the Clintons. That's all I can say. In 2008, Hillary Clinton was the favorite. She was inevitable. And then Democrats realized that they didn't really like her that much, and they went with Barack Obama, and they couldn't wait. She won here in California, that's true, but there are many, you know, obviously Barack Obama won the primary. I just think that this reminds, I know that, look, I'm a Republican, I'm not going to vote for her. I have seen the Clintons do things I considered highly unethical, so I can hardly be shocked. But I think where this hurts her is it reminds a lot of Democrats that they're going to have to be defending her and her arrogant style for a long time. And I think a lot of Democrats are wondering if this is something that they really feel like doing.
My thinking is, so the Associated Press did a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, to get emails. And they've gone through them, and what they found, in addition to being secretive, Hillary is also a bit of a technoklutz when it comes to email. They found a particular one email that she sent by accident to her aide, Huma Abedin, I think that's her last name, that's Mr. Weiner's wife. And in the email she sends to Huma, she says, "I really like the patio furniture, but I'm not sure about the other decor. What do you think?" And Huma responds, "Are you sure you meant to send this to me?" So I'm not sure what's in the missing emails in terms of scandal so much as maybe it just reveals that Hillary, like so many of us who talk too much on our cell phones and spend too many emails, ultimately our lives are kind of banal. How many of you walk through a grocery store, and it drives me crazy when people are on their cell phones in grocery stores. How lonely are you if you have to talk to people while you're shopping? Just shut up and shop. Yet you hear people talking, and because it's dead quiet in the grocery store, you have to hear what they're talking about. And guess what? 98% of conversations are boring. You know, "Oh, what do you want for dinner, honey? Blah, blah, blah." I suspect if you go into Hillary's emails of the 30,000 missing emails or whatever, there may be a few interesting things here and there in terms of her husband or AIDS or, you know, Libya or what have you. But you find the vast majority of them are just kind of dull. So maybe she just doesn't want to introduce us to the dullty of her life as well.
I agree with Saunders here that this is having a corrosive effect on Hillary Clinton. We've seen it in the polls this week, where in Florida and so in Pennsylvania, Rand Paul is ahead of her in Pennsylvania now. But I think the other danger is it sort of reminds Democrats that all their eggs are in one basket here. If some other shoe drops, they're in a dangerous place. On the other hand, Bill, your point is made, and I think that's true. In a technological age, we know, Colin Powell used private email, Condoleezza Rice, Madeleine Albright, and now the AP story about state officials this week showed every one of them used private email.
California.
Yeah, in California. This is not uncommon, and I think in the end, are Americans going to use this as the one barometer of whether they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton or not? I don't think so. I think it's going to be about where does she stand on issues that they care about.
What it does tie to it, I think, is this. You have seen so many behind-the-scenes stories written about her campaign, who they're hiring, but now inside baseball stories and mechanical stories about how are we going to roll her out? How are we going to present her to the American people? Politico, the Washington publication, calls it Hillary 5.0. Like software, this is the fifth version of Hillary you're getting. She will be 69 years old about 10 days before Election Day 2016. And if you're talking about somebody who's been on the national stage for almost a quarter of a century, who's had high-profile positions as a first lady, a senator, and a secretary of state, yet you're having conversations about who is she, what does she stand for, how are we going to present her, she has a problem as a candidate. And it tells you two things. Number one, she doesn't necessarily have a ready-made core of beliefs to present to the people. She's going to have to kind of wet her finger and figure where she is. But secondly, she's not likable fundamentally. They're going to have to find a way to package her and make her likable. This is why I think that memo went out the other week saying, here are 50 words you cannot say about Hillary Clinton.
but
abrasive and divisive and polarizing, blah, blah, blah.
But the question comes down to, are these emails going to be the deciding factor for a lot of voters? And I just don't think they are. I think they want to. You're absolutely right. They want to know who she is and what she stands for on a lot of key issues. And we still have not heard those conversations sort of fleshed out yet. But whether this issue is going to be the deciding, I just don't think that's.
Yeah, I think after a quarter century, we do know where she stands
on a lot of issues. Yeah, but we still haven't had the in-depth conversation with her, and we haven't in the media on a lot of these issues. I think we hope that the House Republicans, with continual inquiries and requests for information, and now they've asked her to testify again in private this time, and the Democrats are saying no, let her do it in public, so things aren't leaked out. I mean, this has become a partisan war over Hillary, and I think at some point you're right. The voters kind of tune all that out, and they're going to look at each of these candidates. And elections, as we know, are about a choice. Yeah, she's going to be 69 years old, and yes, she's going to be on the stage for more than a decade. But it's all about who's on the other side, who's up against her, and that's where Americans will make the choice.
Something. If it's Bush Clinton, shoot me. I mean, I just don't want to go through that again. And I really feel that one of the things that does hurt her is Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush hurts Hillary Clinton. Because people are wondering, this is a big country. How many people in this country, Bill? Y'all know the answer.
320, I think.
Yeah. And we can't find somebody to represent the parties outside of two families.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Congratulations, they're applauding you now. Well, I always figured when I pass someone talking on their cell phone or I read someone's emails in secret, I want to see or hear, where did I hide the money? I'll tell you. But it's never that. Well, let's talk about some other people who want to be on that final ticket. We got our first, I know you're excited about this, our long national nightmare is over. We have our first official declared presidential candidate. He's someone you might have heard of. His name is Ted Cruz. I'm going to steal a line from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. They mentioned that Ted Cruz is so far the only candidate in the race, and he's already in last place. So, you can thank Peter Sagal, not me. I just have his haircut. Okay, now, this is actually somewhat of a rare program. We have two Republicans on the stage here. Deborah, tell us about Ted Cruz. Were you thinking?
I'm not a fan of Ted Cruz. I do not forgive him for that government shutdown that led the Republicans into the Box Canyon where they became sitting ducks, and I think a number of Republicans feel that way about Ted Cruz. Now, he could read Green Eggs and Ham. That was fun, right? But I see him as somebody who, I'm glad he got in first. He can take all those lemmings with him over there who want to follow him, and then we'll see some better candidates step up.
Bill?
I think he'll be the nominee, and I think he'll be the next president of the United States.
No, you don't.
It's April the 1st, people. Bishop. Yeah, look, I'm with Deborah. I think if Ted Cruz is the answer, you're asking the wrong question. Plain and simple. But that said, because he is so easy to lampoon, the appearance and the actions and all that, we forget one thing. This is a pretty smart guy. This is a guy who's argued cases before the Supreme Court and won. This is a Harvard-educated lawyer. And this is a guy who's excruciatingly smart and brilliant at one thing, which is promoting Ted Cruz, which is why I suspect he's in this race. Well, that and Lyndon Johnson creating a state law which allows him to run in two races at the same time. Ted Cruz understands if he doesn't run in 2016, he potentially loses his place in line. As what? The darling of conservative talk radio. And look how talk radio and Fox News, to an extent, have already rushed to his defense. It's sort of like the Indiana law in that regard. There's a action and an opposite reaction to these things. Cruz, I think, understands that if he doesn't run for president, then in terms of being a national figure, he gets supplanted. He gets supplanted potentially by the likes of, let's say, a Ben Carson. He gets supplanted by somebody else as a libertarian, anti-Washington, anti-IRS voice. So there is a method to his madness. I think in his heart of hearts, he knows he can't win, but he stays relevant within the party by doing so.
You know, I think one of the most interesting stories about Ted Cruz was one written by Charlie LaDuff, our former colleague here in the Bay Area. Ted Cruz has talked about his father being someone who was tortured and imprisoned in Cuba. But what he doesn't say is that the father fought on the side of Castro and was imprisoned by the Batista regime. Now, how did the dad get here to the United States during the Cold War as somebody who fought for, Fidel Castro? That has still been answered. So just as... just as Barack Obama had to take a lot of, Kenya, blah, blah, blah. I think the questions aren't over with Ted Cruz. It's going to be very entertaining to watch him and watch him sort of compete for this evangelical vote with Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, Carson, you mentioned. I mean, it's going to be a free-for-all, and I just can't wait to see those debates. This is going to be fun.
Well, someone who might be in those debates, or someone who is 90% likely to be in those debates, is Carly Fiorina. Josh Richman, who's a frequent member of this panel, said, Carly Fiorina had said she's 90% likely to run. And Josh said she's 90% likely to run, 0% likely to win. But she is smart. I mean,
here in California, yeah. Somebody ran for Senate, and both Deborah and I know her well. She was somebody who I have to say was a great candidate in one-on-one. This was a woman who'd sit down with you, tell you her life story, and she has a very compelling life story. Mm-hmm. A former secretary, somebody who really came up through the ranks, ran a Fortune 20 company. Will she be? And I think she's been going gangbusters in terms of making her case out there. Whether she's really running for president, I think, is the question. Or is she running to be Treasury Secretary or Vice President? I think it's refreshing that she's in this mix because she's going to be a voice, I think, that is going to be heard. And she's already shown herself to be very effective at getting press. And and unlike most of the other, almost every one of the other presidential candidates, I have to say, she is open to talking to the media and answering questions, and I give her a lot of respect for that.
When I wrote that column about how she had not paid off $500,000 in debt from her 2010 Senate campaign, and that she was the deadbeat...
Deadbeat Carly,
the deadbeat,
wasn't it?
The deadbeat presidential candidate, I didn't get any return phone calls. And I tried for a couple days... So that was the one time she was rather inaccessible. I should note that afterward, Carly Fiorina did pay off the political consultants and the widow Shoemate and others, which is good to see. I'm glad that she realized that she had to do that. You know, what's really amazing about Carly Fiorina is she was one of the best Republican candidates I've ever seen. In 2010, because she, well, I rarely related to a candidate in my life. Now, I started out as a secretary. She studied medieval history. I studied Greek and Latin. I really related to her. I mean, she's 20 times more successful than me, but I really felt like I could talk to her and sort of understand her. And it didn't help. The truth is, everybody thought she'd really do a lot better than Meg Whitman. She didn't. They both lost big. And now she's out on the trail, and she's doing a great job. She was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, and she wowed him. And she has great answers. She's saddled by what happened at HP and the layoffs and the offshoring. The advantage she has is that as a woman, she can go after Hillary Clinton in a way men may fear to do. And she just looks better than all the rest of the candidates. She's good looking. But what I really learned in 2010 is you can be a great candidate and it really doesn't get you where you need to be.
Where is she on the spectrum, if you will, on issues? Would you consider her a conservative?
She's decidedly conservative. Full disclosure, she is an overseer at the institution at which I work. She's a smart candidate in this race in this regard. She recognizes what Deborah just mentioned. It is from Rick Lazio, who first ran against Hillary Clinton. Even Barack Obama discovered this, running against her. It is difficult to beat up Hillary Clinton and not be tagged as mean, not liking women, being a misogynist to some extent. She could get away with this because of her gender. Point number two, come the time of a Republican debate, I was on Hugh Hewitt's radio show the other day. Hugh Hewitt's the radio host who's hosting one of the first Republican debates. He doesn't know I was going to run this debate because you're going to have a dozen people on the stage. Think about this, a 90-minute debate, if everybody gets 1 minute for a question and 1 minute for a closing statement, opening statement, closing statement, a third of the debate's gone right there. But as the only woman on the stage, she will stand out. And I think, yes, she's making the other calculation that if the only way to attack Hillary is with another woman, then the Republicans will need to put a woman on the ticket. And it's not exactly a long list around the country of women who could be on the ticket. She would be in that conversation. I'm not sure she would get it. But this is why, again, like with Ted Cruz, I think he himself in the conservative conversation, this is why you run for a national office, not expecting to win the race. Joe Biden is the best example of this. Joe Biden ran in 2008 for two reasons. Number one, he was simply bored sitting in the United States Senate. He'd been there for 30, 40, 50 years, however long, and just money was burning a hole in his pocket, and so he ran. One final gesture, but not a futile gesture, because he figured if he played nice, it was nice to Hillary Clinton, he'd become her Secretary of State. Well, he made the correct calculation, play nice, and he got an even bigger job, Vice President. So this is part of the calculation that goes into running for president. It's not always to win. It's sometimes to set yourself up to win the next time, or if you don't see yourself getting to the finish line, run a credible race so I get something in the next administration.
Okay, you already suggested Barney Frank is not the number one person to go to talk about Republicans. However, Barney Frank also had something to do, say, about your boy, Scott Walker. He said, keep an eye on him because he's a conservative evangelical who goes over a little softer than, you know, fewer hard edges, if you will, than Rick Santorum or some of the others who really turn off some folks.
He's allergic to dogs.
That was one of my news questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You saw that too.
Yes, I did. He's allergic to dogs. That's right. But of course, President Obama has a Portuguese water dog because two now because they're hypoallergenic. So we'll see if we see if we see if we see more Portuguese water dogs on the campaign trail. You have to be pro dog. Sorry.
So Scott Walker, I think, fills at least one thing. We were talking about this the other day, Carl and I were, about Jeb Bush coming to Silicon Valley, and I went on one of my usual endless preambles and discussions about this, and I don't know if Carl even records this now, she just rolls her eyes back or goes off for 20 minutes. But in Silicon Valley, talk to Republicans there, and there's one overarching theme to them. They are tired of losing presidential elections. And just like in 2000 when George W. Bush came out here, they want somebody who they think is a leader and somebody can win a national election, and that's a large part of the Jeb Bush draw now. They think he's a good executive. They like when he talks about education, immigration. They think he gets it, in their view, and they think he can win a national election. Now, not necessarily to Silicon Valley crowd, but to other Republicans around the country right now, they're seeing that with Scott Walker. They think that he's got a pair. He has won 3 elections in Wisconsin and over a 4-year period. He is tough, he is principled, and they think that he would run a tough, credible race against Hillary. So that's the void he's stepping into right now. It's the leadership void, and it's the perceived toughness void, and yes, the conservative void.
And I think he's a favorite with the small donor base. Yes. Not the big donor base, but the small donors.
And Bill, you talked about this the other day. And that's where Jeb Bush has a huge advantage. He's only not only got his own Rolodex, he's got his dad's Rolodex, he's got his brother's Rolodex, and that is a huge fundraising base.
But he has a disadvantage in that he is, at the end of the day, royalty. He is part of a political clan which has been in national politics now. The father becomes vice president in 1981. It's been a 35-year run now of Bush's in national politics. And so you hear Scott Walker do this almost every day. It's a death of a thousand cuts. It's a little cut here. You know, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. My daddy wasn't famous. I was the son of a pastor. I didn't go to an Ivy League school. It's just Nick, Nick, Nick going after him all the time. This is the same problem Hillary had faced, by the way, if instead of a Jim Webb or a Bernie Sanders, who I guess was here the other day, she ran against
Sanders
or Saunders?
Sanders.
Okay, Colonel Sanders.
Like, we're not related.
Yeah. Hillary would have very much the same problem if she ran against Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren, even though she is Ivy League professor and all that, she would likewise carve up Hillary as elitist and royal. So it's a problem for Bush going forward, is how to fight off the populist surge.
You know, I think we should talk about Bernie Sanders, too, because he was here at the Commonwealth Club. I also interviewed him. He was a sellout here at the Commonwealth Club. He was a hot ticket, and it sounded to me, I think he's going to run. It sounded he came very close to saying that when I interviewed him. I think he's going to do it as a Democrat because it will give him media exposure. And his whole point is we need somebody on the progressive side to the left of Hillary to challenge, to stand up on issues like educational reform, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I think he wants to see a debate. And I think you're going to see that on the Democratic side. And the fact that you had such a turnout here to see him shows there's a certain hunger out there on the Democratic side for some other voice out there.
So like Carly probably running, not really expecting to be the presidential nominee, but angling for something else. You think he might be running, not expecting to be the presidential candidate,
yeah, I think
but to push the presidential nominee.
Bernie Sanders of Vermont. I get that right?
Yes.
Thank you. Bernie Sanders running against Hillary Clinton, he's a gnat. She'll just swat him away. He'll get a small protest. Yeah, he will, please. Let's be realistic. If he really wanted to make a difference, if he really wanted to get to her attention, he would not run in the primaries. He would threaten to run in the general election. He's already said he won't do this because he doesn't want to be Ross Perot. He doesn't want to be Ralph Nader. But the threat alone of running in an Ohio or a Florida or Virginia where he couldn't get Nader-like runners numbers, I'm convinced. Bernie Sanders is a lot of things. He looks like Larry David. He sounds like Larry David. And after listening to him for an hour, I'm reminded, I don't want to ride on an airplane with Larry David. I'd want to turn him off at a certain point. Bernie, to me, is that way. He cannot get Ralph Nader numbers, but he could pull away enough votes from the Democratic bloc to seriously screw up.
Specifically asked about that. He said he will not be a spoiler.
But my point, though, is Bernie wants to get his agenda into the Democratic mix. He wants to get on a radar screen, and he wants to do what Elizabeth Warren has already done. And Hillary is now talking about income disparity. And why is that? Because she feels Elizabeth Warren breathing down her neck. So she wants to placate Elizabeth Warren and that side of the party. Bernie wants a piece of the action, too. But in the primaries, where I'm sorry, he's really pretty much an afterthought when you get down to it, because he just doesn't have the muscle in the organization and the money. He's an afterthought. If he really wanted to scare her and get her attention, he would talk about running in the general election. Count my words, if he actually credibly went forward with that, he would have her attention.
Okay, well, let's try to get into some other political news quickly here. Harry Reid, the former Senate Majority Leader, now the Senate Minority Leader, announced he will not run for re-election. Were you surprised, Deborah?
Pleasantly surprised. And I think that the big story, of course, right now on Harry Reid is that Dana Bash from CNN interviewed him, and she asked him about when he went on the Senate floor and said that Mitt Romney had not paid taxes, any taxes, for years. And she said, gee, do you think maybe that was a little McCarthyistic? And he looked at her and he said, Mitt Romney lost, didn't he? So, I mean, you know, he's Dirty Harry. And I think the Senate will be a better institution without him.
I wrote a piece on Harry Reid for my blog, and my blog pieces get picked up by another website called Ricochet. www.calm.com, which is a very thoughtful place, very, very kind of smart people, calm people read and they react, and you have nice long discussions about policy. The piece on Harry Reid gets posted, and half a dozen responses all go around the fact that Harry Reid had an accident in his home in December, about a month after the election, and he fell down on a treadmill or something, and he broke several ribs and several bones in his face and really messed up his eye, almost lost his eye, and looks like 5 miles of bad road. Half a dozen posts on this blog about, well, you know, the mob got to him. The mob beat him up. It's all conspiracy theory. Somebody actually did something very funny, I thought, actually. He said, I understood he had a meeting in Las Vegas with these two guys, and they ran a picture of Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci from Casino. Yeah. But this is Harry Reid in a nutshell. We talk about dog whistles and what drives the left crazy and the right crazy. Harry Reid does it for the right because they see him as dirty. They see him as a person who blocks action in the Senate, a guy who bends the rules in the Senate, and really a scorched earth politician. Interestingly enough, the next Senate leader will probably be the lovely Chuck Schumer from New York. No sweetheart he. So the Senate is really going to be a fascinating place in the next few years. I think there are 23 or 24 Republican seats up in the next cycle and only 10 for the Democrats, including Reid's, but only two of those seats are in trouble. That would be Reid's in Nevada and Michael Bennett's in Colorado. So if the Republican, if the Democrats run the table in a lot of blue states where Republicans are, it's kind of like 2014 in reverse, the Democrats could be back in power in the Senate in 2016, but then you fast forward to 2018 when I think there are 24 Democrat seats up and 8 Republican, flip, flop, flip, back and forth. So this goes into thinking, someone like Kamala Harris is going to go to the Senate. She's going to have to pick up and move across the aisle time and again as she's on majorities and minorities back and forth. So, but no, Harry Reid will not be missed. He won't be missed by Republicans. I'm just not sure if he's going to be missed in the Washington.
There are a lot of Democrats who did not do well with him in the leadership and who did not survive. So
we should have seen this coming, by the way, because one of the things that drove conservatives crazy about Harry Reid was how he talked about being an ordinary guy from Searchlight, Nevada, which is a one-horse town outside of Las Vegas. Harry lived in the Ritz-Carlton in Washington in a $4 million condo. He sold the condo last summer, so we probably should have known that he was thinking about bailing.
I mean, I don't have anything to add in. Since, as Deborah said, the Republicans are happy that he's going. I think they should be careful what they wish for, because I think Chuck Schumer is going to be a very formidable, he's a throwdown politician, and he is going to be extremely aggressive. So it's going to be very interesting to watch the fireworks in Washington.
All aggressive.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some more local stuff. Voting. Carla, you mentioned this. John Avalos wants to expand the vote. What does he want to do? Why does he want to do it? Is there any chance?
Deborah wrote such a great column on this, and one of the few times when I agree with her on this totally. His proposal is that perhaps 16-year-olds should be allowed to vote in San Francisco. The argument being they have a stake in what goes on here. Why not? Deborah, your argument, I think, was right on the money.
I mean, this is, to me, it's one of those ideas that the supervisors come up with. It would go before the voters of San Francisco, and they're not going to pass it, just as they didn't pass measures to allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. It's just not going to happen. It's a headline in search of a whatever. But I called John Avalos and asked him about it, and I talked to somebody from the Youth Commission, too. And I said, well, okay, so if somebody is old enough to vote, that means that they should be old enough to drink, right? No. They should be old enough to buy cigarettes, right? No. And finally, he said to me, I didn't say they're adults. Oh, so they're not, so they're old. They're not old enough to make decisions for themselves, but they are old enough to make decisions for other people. So anyway, I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Your point was so well taken, which is, listen, if they have a stake in what goes on in San Francisco, well, so do I. I work here and have worked here for decades, and I may live in Oakland, but I probably have more of a stake here in what goes on in San Francisco. So maybe they should open it up to anyone who works here in San Francisco. I mean, it's just one proposal, and we saw Secretary of State Alex Padilla throw out the idea of expanding voter registration in California. It was yet another voting proposal to allow everyone to be automatically registered to vote. This is similar to an Oregon.
This follows. L.A. is so desperate to get people to vote. Their turnouts are so low that they actually are looking at having a lottery so that if you show up and vote, you might win prize money.
And I called up
the woman who was behind it, Jessica Levinson, very smart woman, and I said to her, gee, have you noticed that you keep making it easier and easier to register and easier and easier to vote and fewer people are doing it? They're desperately trying to get people more engaged. And of course, part of the problem is this is a one-party state. Now, if you're a single mom and you're really trying to get the kids to school and work and do all these other things, do you really care which Democrat is controller? I don't think so. So you have these city elections, and it's basically a personality thing. So of course the turnout's low. You want higher turnout? You have to have a more heated election, more competition.
I don't think it's necessarily about a one-party state. We've seen there are other states. Oregon is an example. But I just think voters are more and more just fed up with the whole system and the whole partisan politics and the negative aspect that they just. And the money in politics, exactly right, that they just check out of this. No, I'm not saying that to you, Carla. I agree with you totally. If you can't register to vote now when it's so easy, do you really want these people to vote? I mean, I'm not sure that that's a good thing.
Well, listen, everybody, much more to discuss on Monday, April 13th at our next week-to-week political roundtable right here in San Francisco. Thank you to our panel, Carla Marinucci, Bill Whalen, and Deborah J. Saunders. Thanks to all of you and everyone listening online, watching on TV. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.